This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Posters in this country largely reflect American pop culture, but in Japan, they've come to represent post-war Japan's dramatic economic and cultural transformation. Experts describe them as elegant and extravagant, and they are the focus of an exhibit at UNC's Ackland Art Museum. The Elegance and Extravagance poster exhibit joins other works of art in the museum's installation, A Season of Japan. It began in September, is going to run until January 6th, and today Peter Nisbet is here. He's museum curator, and Jennifer Weisenfeld is a professor of art and art history as well as visual studies at Duke. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Peter, tell us what gave you the idea, first of all, for the overall exhibit, The Season of Japan.
Well, it all started when I arrived in Chapel Hill about 3 years ago, and actually one of the attractions of coming to be at the Ackland was the extraordinary Asian collection. The Ackland has an Asian collection of national consequence. The only one in the state as well. So it's very, very important for us at the Ackland to maintain the momentum with this Asian collection and keep it active, keep people coming to see it. And I've been a long time enthusiast for Japanese art and culture. And it just made sense, I think, to try to activate the collection with all these different exhibitions and activities and programs and films around Japanese art that we've had in the fall.
Well, Jennifer, tell us about the importance of this type of art, these posters, and what they tell us about culture and the history of Japan.
Yes, well, as you know, the poster is one of these media that bridges between the mass media, and the arts, the high arts. And so it speaks to both of those spheres. It has diffuse dissemination. It's reaching everyday people in everyday spaces, but it's also representing the highest quality of aesthetics. And so therefore, it's really the perfect medium for really looking at the particular moments of when it's produced.
And they are very particular to a time and a place. That's the other wonderful thing about a poster, isn't it? I mean, it could represent 2 weeks in the life of a country.
Yes. And the ones that Peter's excellently selected from this wonderful collection of Merrill Berman's really represent certain important nodes as well in Japanese post-war history, important institutions, important world expositions, the Olympics in 1964, which was the moment when Japan re-entered the world of nations. There are so many historical moments here, including major corporate sponsors who have redeveloped and re-sustained Japan's modern economy after the war. So there's so many different points that it's interesting.
And tell me again about the larger Asian collection. How did the Ackland come to acquire these works and get such a large collection?
Well, the Ackland has always been, ever since it was founded in 1958, has always been in principle open to art from any culture. That's one of our special strengths, I think. We have Inuit art, we have Islamic, we have African, we have Western, and this good Asian collection. Our Asian collection became especially strong beginning in the 1980s because a highly respected connoisseur of Japanese art named Sherman Lee, who had led important museums all over the United States, he moved to Chapel Hill after he stepped down from his professional life and began advising the Ackland and advising private collectors and donating, in fact, things from his own personal collection. So we had the best advice, the best eye on our Asian collection we could possibly have hoped for.
And so ingenious to use these posters, Jennifer, as you said, they bridge these worlds between the sort of popular culture and high art. And a real way in for us, because if we show the high art of a particular period in Japan, we'd have to know a little bit about its antecedents, what came before it, and what movement this represents. But here we get to see it with our own eyes. Here's a picture of the monkeys, a poster of the monkeys in the 1960s, reflected in Japanese poster art.
Yes, and what's so wonderful about this show is that when we start to get into the post-war era, it is such a transnational, international sphere that everyone can understand, even when they don't know Japan, they can understand some of the motifs. For instance, the Olympics, understanding reading that, or understanding pop culture and pop music like the Monkees, or and many of these artists are so they are so fluent in the language of the international avant-garde and the modernists. And Peter's pointed out that they were very steeped in the Bauhaus. And so they have, they're conversant in a language that even American and European audiences can understand very well. And they can tap into this, these particular moments.
That's what was interesting to me is as I look through the catalog and you can see these posters. If he hadn't told me they were Japanese art or Japanese posters, I might not have known. They don't reach the eye as something I might consider kind of Japanese graphic art.
Yes, and that's been part of my goal in my scholarship, is to really speak to a global sphere of artistic production, to think about the 20th century and the 21st century as a dialogue among world artists. But of course, there's a local particularity to Japan as well. And if you were to look at some of the posters, you would, of course, notice the language differences, the meta-language differences. And they are also speaking to particular events that are distinctive and important for Japan. And so we have to have a balance between the universal and the particular here.
And Peter, I saw that you questioned my premise as well.
Yes, I mean, I think there are a couple of things that I would add to that. One is these are posters for particular events or occasions, yes. But we've tried to show multiple posters by a number of artists, and I would call them artists. So you get a sense not only of the historical moment when they're being made, but of an artistic style, of an aesthetic position. And I think some of these poster designers reached the rank of high art in their sophistication, in their consciousness of their medium, in their adaptation of traditions in the national culture. They can stand as artists equal to any in painting or sculpture. And I think one of the interesting aspects of the show is you see these artists engaging with international trends in art, but also looking back on their national traditions and wondering how do we reactivate these? How do we connect with the tradition of no drama? Or how do we connect with the aesthetics of the 19th century woodblock print, which I think other exhibitions at the Acklin now help our viewers to understand that dialogue.
And forgive me, but it would seem to be a particularly challenging question in post-World War II Japan. Here's a country that has had a dramatic break with its history in the post-World War II era. And so how is that reflected in these posters, and to what extent is there continuity, and where do we see the desire to recall the past?
Well, one could argue that there is as much continuity as there is break. And if you look at the biographies of these particular designers, what's so striking is how many of them were very active in the pre-war period and during the wartime. They got their professional training working for commercial and national propaganda activities. They were very well honed in their skills by the time they came into the post-war. And I think in many ways that training continues and some of the concerns continue. And one thing I wanted to echo or at least amplify in what Peter was just mentioning is that the nation is extremely important in this story, how the nation is articulated, and the tradition itself is not something that's a given. The Japanese designers are picking and choosing among the past motifs, the time periods, and actively constructing a tradition to resuscitate the nation. Many of them are extremely patriotic, so that's also a continuity that you feel very strongly in the post-war period.
And Peter, even though you say they certainly do hold their own and stand up as art, they're advertising, so they have to appeal to a mass audience and bring them in, right?
Well, what is interesting is how few of the posters are actually for commercial products. There are so many of them that are for cultural events or political events or about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, about atomic war, that they're really as much about the culture around them as they are about commerce. And that's, I think, something that's special to Japanese posters, that yes, there are a lot of commercial ones. They're not in the exhibition, But they're aiming in a way at a different conversation. It's a conversation about culture more than commerce.
Well, and I would just argue that commerce is culture, and that one thing that has struck me looking at Japanese companies, major corporations from the turn of the century to now, is how innovative they have been in directing visual culture and the visuality of Japan. I'll just bring one example, is Shiseido. And I think that's a company certainly most American consumers would know about. Major cosmetics company, has been around for over 100 years. And their company president was actively involved in the production of publicity. He was a major amateur photographer at the time. And they have continued to produce aesthetically worthy and commercially viable, interesting mass culture objects. And so I think that the idea that commerce is not a culture, or that it can't be culturally innovative, we might need to rethink that a little bit.
And were some of these trends with the graphics that we can see in these posters, were they also evident in the pre-war period?
Well, certainly with the works of Hara, for instance, Hiromu Hara or Yusaku Kamekura, we do see a lot of continuity with their interest in abstraction, Bauhaus compositions, the importance of minimalism in a sense, or that tension between motifs that are recognizably Japanese and traditional, and then their abstraction or how they're transformed geometrically into compositions. But then there are plenty of new developments. If you think about Yoko Tadanori's psychedelia of the 60s and 70s and his connection to counterculture, there's a lot of new things that he's doing. And he's tapping into the floating world of the ukiyo-e print to update images of that era. So there's just as many sources as there are individuals, really.
What types of art, Peter, would we expect to see in
this
exhibit?
I think it was very hard to come up with a title for this show that unified all these posters. Elegance and extravagance was the best that I could do, trying to call on at least two traditions in Japanese culture. There is that elegance of design. There is a kind of refinement in Japanese culture that is seen as one of the continuities. And extravagance, too, in some of the more explosive, psychedelic, overpacked, electrifying posters by some of the other artists. And then there are some who are just enormously humorous and witty. It's extraordinary to see that level of sophisticated wit in posters like this. And I think the exhibition in some ways offers something for everyone in terms of one's taste. I like to think so anyway.
Jennifer, maybe I could ask you to describe a couple of the posters for us, and as you do, talk about the posters that really strike you and talk about some of the elements of design and culture that are evident in the posters.
Well, of course, they do span tremendously, so it's very hard out of 80-some-odd posters to pick any one that really stands out. But if you were to walk into that first room as you go into the exhibition, you might see a very spare image of the rising sun and an image that also shows the linked circles of the Olympic Games and the 1964 Olympics. And so this would be a very spare but very powerful image of that icon and the linking of the circle with the rising sun, bringing together the new national emblem, because the rising sun flag was not re-ratified after the defeat of Japan, and so it was still under debate whether that flag would be used after the war. So it's very symbolic to see how designers visually can bring together a national symbol and an international symbol of the Olympics to try to renormalize these kinds of motifs. So that's by Hara Hiromu. If you were to move down, you would see a wonderful image by Yusaku Kamekura for the World Expo in Osaka. This was the first world exposition that was ever held in Asia in 1970. And it has this bursting starburst image, and it's very abstract. Originally, I think it was supposed to be in multiple colors to be kind of the rainbow of the world, but ultimately the design team. And one thing I want to emphasize is that as much as we're talking about individuals, design is produced by teams of people, art directors, individuals, photographers. It's not the kind of solo subjective art that you have for high art that you think of, and so it has to be considered as a collaborative endeavor. But this has this radiating, they decided rather than the rainbow to make it gold, because the gold tied in with a kind of decorative tradition in Japan, but it's a very abstract geometric burst, and in the middle is the Expo logo, which is these lobes, but when they're colored red, they look like a cherry blossom, which is another very recognizable symbol of Japan itself.
You know, Peter, you said that most of these posters, and it's true, are about cultural events. So it's not necessarily, you know, for posters for Wheaties or even pop culture thing. Although there is some of that.
Yes.
That. But is this kind of art then reflected in pop culture graphic design in the Mad Men of Japan in the 50s and 60s? Were they using these kinds of images and techniques in mass marketing, or was mass marketing developed to that level?
I expect so. I have to confess I'm an enthusiast, but I'm not an expert. And my guess is that the transition from the more culturally inflected posters to the more commercially inflected ones is a smooth one, that one can't make an absolute kind of distinction. But I do think that there is enough aesthetic coherence in each individual artist's work that one can speak of a style of that artist, a point of view of that artist, an interpretation of the world that artist is actually making. And I wouldn't be surprised if that didn't come up in their more commercial work too.
Jennifer, in your studies, what have you found about the relationship between, say, commercial art and this kind of poster art?
I think the commercial concerns are very interested in tapping into these kinds of cutting-edge aesthetics. And I just think, for instance, of the Seibu department store, for instance, that has been at the front line of hiring some of the most prominent Japanese graphic designers and using them to create a whole new branding mechanism for them to really stand out. And you have to think about this, that these are companies that are trying to break through the clutter of advertising. And so they need this kind of innovative aesthetics to create a branding and a corporate identity. And I think Seibu is one of the great examples of that. And they've been pioneers in working hand in hand with graphics.
Very much a part of the global economy, very much a part of the global culture, so conscious of what design and graphics are going to work. So we talked about design as a collaborative, a kind of endeavor. What was happening in the art world, the fine art world in Japan at this time, among those individual artists? Is much of their work reflected in these posters, or would we see the same kinds of design aesthetics?
Well, I think it really depends on the individual. But perhaps if we take Yoko Tadanori as a good example, because I think he is the best crossover artist who really had a very sustained career as an artist and as a commercial designer. And a lot of his work was done for subculture, counterculture, avant-garde, theater groups. He had a very strong identity within that subculture. And you can see the kind of performance art, almost a neo-Dada aesthetic in his works, some forms of nihilism almost. There's a great poster that he has showing his own death in his 1920s, and it's everything is very tongue-in-cheek. There's a lot of irony and absurdity in these works, and I think that ties into some of the great movements of performance art of the 60s and 70s, if you think of High Red Center, for instance, or the Gutai Group, or the Neo-Dada organizers. These were all very well-established performance art groups that were doing happenings in the streets of Tokyo.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Look forward to seeing the exhibit. Peter Nisbet and Jennifer Weisenfeld, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you very much, Frank.
A Season of Japan is at the Ackland Art Museum until January 6th. Coming up, music for the season, John Brown and Nina Freelon, live on The State of Things. Do stay tuned.